Chapter 8. In my lifelong study of the scores of species of ants to be found in the tropical forests of Dalhon, I am led to the conviction that all forms of life are engaged in a struggle to survive, and that within each species there exists a range of natural but variable proclivities, of physical condition and of behavior, which in turn weighs for or against in the battle to survive and procreate. Further, it is my suspicion that in the act of procreation such traits are passed on. By extension, one can see that ill traits reduce the likelihood of both survival and procreation. On the basis of these notions, I wish to propose to my fellow scholars at this noble gathering a law of survival that pertains to all forms of life. But before I do so, I must add one more caveat, drawn from the undeniable behavioral characteristics of, in my instance of speciality, ants. To wit, success of one form of life more often than not initiates devastating population collapse among competitors, and indeed sometimes outright extinction, and that such annihilation of rivals may in fact be a defining feature of success. Thus, my colleagues, I wish to propose a mode of operation among all forms of life, which I humbly call, in my 4-volume treatise, The Betrayal of the Fittest. Obsessional Scrolls, 6th Day Proceedings, Address of Skavat Gil, Unta, Malazan Empire, 1097, Burns Sleep. As if riding a scent on the wind, or through the tremble in the ground underfoot, or perhaps the air itself carried alien thoughts, thoughts angry, malign. Whatever the cause, the Kachain Chemal knew they were now being hunted. They had no patience for Kalith and her paltry pace, and it was Gunth Mak, whose posture slowly shifted, spine drawing almost horizontal to the ground, as if in the course of a single morning some force reshaped her skeleton, muscles and joints, and before the sun stood high, she had gathered up the destrient and set her down behind the humped shoulder blades, where the dorsal spikes had flattened and where the thick hide had formed something like a saddle seat. And Kalith found herself riding a Kachain Chemal, the sensation far more fluid than that she recalled of sitting on the back of a horse, so that it seemed they flowed over the broken scrubland at a speed somewhere between a canter and a gallop. Gunth Mak made use of her forelimbs only as they skirted slopes or ascended the occasional low hill. Mostly the scarred, scale-armored arms remained drawn up like the pincers of a mantis. The Kel hunters Rhythok and Korathuran flanked her, with Sag Churok almost a third of a league ahead. Even from her vantage point atop Gunth Mak, Kalith rarely caught sight of the huge creature, a speck of motion betrayed only by its shadow. All of the Kachain Chemal now bore on their scaled hides the mottled hues of the ground and its scant plant cover. And yet, they were afraid. Not of those human warriors who pursued them. That was little more than an inconvenience, an obstacle to their mission. No, instead, the fear within these terrible demons was deeper, visceral. It rode out from Gunthan Asil, the matron, in ice-laden ripples, crowding up against each and every one of her children. The pressure built, grinding, thunderous.
A war is coming. We all know this. But as to the face of this enemy, I alone am blind. Destriant, what does it mean to be one? To these creatures, what faith am I supposed to shape? I have no history to draw from, no knowledge of Kachain Chemal legends or myths, assuming they have any. Gunthan Asil has fixed her eyes upon humankind. She would pillage the beliefs of my kind. She is indeed mad. I can give them nothing.
She would pluck not a single fragment from her own people. They were all dead, after all, betrayed by their own faiths, that the rains would always come, that the land would ever provide, that children would be born and mothers and aunts would raise them, that there would be campfires and singing and dancing and loves and passions and laughter. All lies, delusions, false hopes. There was no point in stirring those ashes. What else was left to her, then, to make this glorious new religion? When countless thousands of lizard eyes fixed unblinking on her, what could she offer them? They had travelled east for the morning, but were now angling southward once more, and Calith sensed a gradual slowing of pace, and as they slipped over a low rise, she caught sight of Sag Churok, stationary and apparently watching their approach. Something had happened. Something had changed. A gleam of weathered white, the trunk of a fallen tree, amidst the low grasses directly ahead, and for the first time Calith was jolted as Gantz Mak leapt to one side to avoid it. As they passed the object, the destrian saw that it was a long bone. Whatever it had belonged to, she realized, must have been enormous. The other Kachain Chimal were reacting in a like manner as each came upon another skeletal remnant, dancing away as if the splintered bones exuded some poison aura that assailed their senses. Calith saw that the Kel's flanks glistened, dripping with oil from their glands, and so she knew that they were all afflicted by an extremity of emotion, terror, rage. She had no means of reading such things. Was this yet another killing field? She wasn't sure, but something whispered to her that all of these broken bones belonged to a single gargantuan beast.
A dragon? Think of the nests, the rooted, carved in the likeness of dragons. Dawn's breath, can this be the religion of the Kachain Chimal? The worship of dragons?
It made a kind of sense. Were these reptiles not physically similar to such mythical beasts? Though she had never seen a dragon, even among her own people there were legends, and in fact she recalled one tale told to her as a child, a fragmented, confused story, which made its recounting rare, since it possessed little entertainment value.
Dragons swim the sky. Fangs slash and blood rains down. The dragons warred with one another, scores upon scores, and the earth below, and all things that dwelt upon it, could do naught but cower. The breath of the dragons made a conflagration of the sky.
They arrived where waited Sag Churok. As soon as Gantz Mak halted, Calith slipped down, her legs almost folding under her. Righting herself, she looked around. Skull fragments, massive fangs chipped and split. It was as if the creature had simply blown apart. Calith looked upward and saw directly overhead a dark speck, wheeling, circling.
He shows himself. This here, this is important.
She finally understood what had so agitated the Kachain Chimal. Not fear, not rage.
Anticipation. They expect something from me.
She fought down a moment of panic. Mouth dry, feeling strangely displaced inside her own body, she wandered into the midst of the bone field. There were gouges scored into the shattered plates of the dragon's skull, the tracks of bites or talons. She found a dislodged tooth and pulled it up from its web of grasses, heavy as a club in her hands, sun-bleached and polished on one side, pitted and stained amber on the other. She thought she might laugh. A part of her had never even believed in dragons. The Kachain Chimal remained at a respectful distance, watching her.
What do you want of me? Should I pray? Raise a cairn from these bones? Let blood?
Her searching gaze caught something, a large fragment of the back of the skull, and embedded in it, she walked closer, crouched down. A fang, much like the one she still carried, only larger and strangely discolored. The sun had failed to bleach this one. The wind and the grit it carried had not pitted its enamel. The rain had not polished its surface. It had been torn from its root, so deeply had it impaled the dragon's skull, and it was the hue of rust. She set down the tooth she had brought over and knelt. Reaching out, she ran her fingers along the reddish fang. Cold as metal, a chill defying the sun and its blistering heat. Its texture reminded Calith of petrified wood. She wondered what creature this could have belonged to.
An iron dragon? But how can that be?
She attempted to remove the tooth, but it would not budge. Sag-Churok spoke in her mind, in a voice strangely faint.
Destriant, in this place it is difficult to reach you. Your mind, the Otataral, would deny us.
The what?
There is no single god. There can never be a single god. For there to be one face, there must be another. The Naruk did not see it in such terms, of course. They spoke of forces in opposition, of the necessity of tension. All that binds must be bound to two foci, at the minimum. Even should a god exist alone, isolated in its perfection, it will come to comprehend the need for a force outside itself, beyond its omniscience. If all remains within, Destriant, exclusively within, that is, then there is no reason for anything to exist, no reason for creation itself. If all is ordered, untouched by chaos, then the universe that was, is, and will ever be, is without meaning, without value. The god would quickly comprehend, then, that its own existence is also without meaning, and so it would cease. It would succumb to the logic of despair.
She was studying the rusty fang as Sag-Churok's words whispered through her head.
I'm sorry, she sighed. I don't understand.
But then maybe she did. The Kachain Chemal resumed.
In its knowledge, the god would understand the necessity for that which lies outside itself, beyond its direct control. In that tension, meaning will be found. In that struggle, value is born. If it suits you and your kind, Destriant, fill the ether with gods, goddesses, first heroes, spirits, and demons. Kneel to one or many, but never, never, Kalith, hold to a belief that but one god exists, that all that is resides within that god. Should you hold such a belief, then by every path of reasoning that follows, you cannot but conclude that your one god is cursed, a thing of impossible aspirations and deafening injustice, whimsical in its cruelty, blind to mercy and devoid of pity. Do not misunderstand me. Choose to live within one god as you like, but in so doing, be certain to acknowledge that there is an other, an existence beyond your god. And if your god has a face, then so too does that other. In such comprehension, Destriant, will you come to grasp the freedom that lies at the heart of all life. That choice is the singular moral act, and all one chooses can only be considered in a moral context if that choice is free.
Freedom. That notion mocked her.
What is this Otataral you spoke of, Sag-Churok?
We are reviled for revealing the face of that other god. That god of negation. Your kind have a flawed notion of magic. You cut the veins of other worlds and drink of the blood. And this is your sorcery. But you do not understand. All life is sorcery. In its very essence, the soul is magical. And each process of chemistry, of obeisance and cooperation, of surrender and of struggle, at every scale conceivable, is a consort of sorcery.
Destroy magic, and you destroy life. There was a long pause, and then a flood of bitter amusement flowed through Kallis. When we kill magic. Consider the magnitude of that crime, if you dare. What is Otataral, you ask? Otataral is the opposite of magic. Negation to creation, absence to presence. If life is your god, then Otataral is the other god, and that god is death. But please understand, it is not an enemy. It is the necessary manifestation of a force in opposition. Both are essential, and together they are bound in the nature of existence itself. We are reviled for revealing the truth. The lesser creatures of this and every other world do not question any of this. Their comprehension is implicit. When we kill the beasts living on this plane, when we close our jaws about the back of the neck, when we grip hard to choke off the windpipe, when we do all this, we watch with intimate compassion, with profound understanding, the light of life leave our victims' eyes. We see the struggle give way to acceptance, and in our souls destriant, we weep. Still she knelt, but now there were tears streaming down her face, as all that Sag-Churok felt was channeled through her, cruel as sepsis, sinking deep into her own soul. The Slayer, the Otataral dragon, has been bound. But it will be freed. They will free it, for they believe that they can control it. They cannot. Destriant, will you now give us the face of our god? She whirled round.
How am I supposed to do that? She demanded. Is this Otataral dragon your god?
No, Destriant, Sag-Churok replied in sorrow. It is the other. She ran her hands through the brittle tangles of her hair.
What you want? That face,
she shook her head.
It can't be dead. It must be alive, a living thing. You built keeps in the shape of dragons, but that face is ruined, destroyed by failure. You were betrayed, Sag-Churok. You all were.
She gestured, encompassing this killing field.
Look here. The other killed your god.
All of the Kachane Chemal were facing her now.
My own people were betrayed as well. It seems,
she added wryly,
we share something after all. It's a beginning of sorts.
She scanned the area once more.
There is nothing here for us.
You misunderstand, Destriant. It is here. It is all here.
What do you want me to do?
She was close to tears yet again, but this time from helplessness.
They're just bones.
She started as Rhythoch stepped forward, massive blades lifting threateningly. Some silent command visibly battered the hunter, and he halted, trembling, jaws half agape. If she failed, she realized, they might well kill her. Cut her down as they had done Red Mask, the poor fool. These creatures managed failure no better than humans.
I'm sorry,
she whispered,
but I don't believe in anything. Not gods, not anything. Oh, they might exist, but about us they don't care. Why should they? We destroy to create. But we deny the value of everything we destroy, which serves to make its destruction easier on our consciences.
All that we reshape to suit us is diminished, its original beauty forever lost. We have no value system that does not beggar the world, that does not slaughter the beasts we share it with, as if we are the gods.
She sank back down onto her knees and clutched the sides of her head.
Where are these thoughts coming from? It was all so much simpler once, here, in my mind, so much simpler. Spirits below, I so want to go back.
She only realized she had been beating at her temples when two massive hands grasped her wrists and pulled down her arms. She stared up into Gunth Mach's emerald eyes. And for the first time, the daughter spoke inside her mind.
Release now. Breathe deep my breath, Destriant.
Kallith's desperate gasping now caught a strange pungent scent emanating from Gunth Mach. The world spun. She sagged back, sprawled to the ground, as something unfolded in her skull like an alien flower, virulent, beguiling. She lost grip of her own body, was whipped away, and found herself standing on cold, damp stone, nostrils filling with a pungent, rank stench. Her eyes adjusted to the gloom, and she cried out and staggered back. A dragon reared above her, its slick scales the color of rust. Enormous spikes pinned its forelimbs, holding the creature up against a massive, gnarled tree. Other spikes had been driven into it, but the dragon's immense weight had pulled them loose. Its wedge-shaped head, big as a migrant's wagon, hung down, streaming drool. The wings were crumpled like storm-battered caravan tents. Fresh blood surrounded the base of the tree, so that it seemed that the entire edifice rose from a gleaming pool.
The Slayer, the Otataral Dragon, has been bound, but it will be freed.
Sag Churok's words echoed in her mind.
They will free it.
Who? No matter, she realized, it would be done. This Otataral Dragon would be loosed upon the world, upon every world. A force of negation, a slayer of magic. And they would lose control of it. Only mad fools could believe they could enslave such an entity.
Wait, she hissed, thoughts racing. Wait! Forces in opposition. Take away one, spike it to a tree, and the other is lost. It cannot exist, cannot survive, looking across the abyss and seeing nothing, no one, no foe. This is why you have lost your god, Sag Churok. Or, if it still lives, it has been driven into the oblivion of insanity. Too alone, an orphan, just like me.
A revelation of sorts. What could she make of it? Kallith stared up at the dragon.
When you are finally freed, then perhaps your other will return to engage with you once more in that eternal battle.
But even then, this scheme had failed before. It would fail again, because it was flawed. Something was wrong. Something was broken.
Forces in opposition, yes. That I do understand. And we each play our roles. We each fashion our others, and chart the course of our lives as that eternal campaign, seasons of gain, seasons of loss. Battles and wounds and triumphs and bitter defeats. In comforts we fashion our strongholds. In convictions we occupy our fortifications. In violence we forge our peace. In peace we win desolation.
Somewhere far behind her, Kallith's body was lying on half-dead grasses, cast down onto the hearthstone of the wastelands.
It is here. It is all here.
We are broken indeed. We are fallen.
What to do, then, when the battle cannot be won? No answers burgeoned before her. The only truth rearing to confront her was this blood-soaked sacrifice, destined to be undone.
Is it true, then, that a world without magic is a dead world? Is this what you promise? Is this to be your future? But no, for when you are at last freed, then your enemy will awaken once more, and the war will resume.
There was no place in that scheme for mortals. A new course for the future was needed. For the Kachain Shemal, for all humans in every empire, every tribe. If nothing changed in the mortal world, then there would be no end to the conflicts, to the interminable forces in opposition, be they cultures, religions, whatever. She had no idea that intelligent life could be so stupid.
They want a face from me, of religion. They want to return to the vanity of the righteous. I can't do it. I can't. Rythok had better kill me, for I will offer them nothing they want to hear.
Abruptly, she was staring up at a cloudless blue sky, heat rustling across her bare limbs, her face, the tracks of dried tears tight on her cheeks. She sat up. Her muscles ached. A sour taste sickened her tongue. Still, the Kachain Shemal faced her.
Very well, she said, rising to her feet. I give you this. Find your faith in each other. Look no further. The gods will war, and all that we do will remain beneath their notice. Stay low. Move quietly, out of sight. We are ants in the grass, lizards among the rocks.
She paused.
Somewhere out there, you will find the purest essence of that philosophy. Perhaps in one person, perhaps in 10,000. Looking to no other entity, no other force, no other will. Bound solely in comradeship, in loyalty honed absolute. Yet devoid of all arrogance. Wise in humility. And that one, or 10,000, is on a path. Unerring, it readies itself not to shake a fist at the heavens, but to lift a lone hand, a hand filled with tears.
She found she was glaring at the giant reptiles.
You want a face? You want someone or something to believe in? No, do not worship the one or the 10,000. Worship the sacrifice they will make, for they make it in the name of compassion. The only cause worth fighting and dying for.
Suddenly exhausted, she turned away, kicked aside the bleached fang at her feet.
Now, let us go find our champions.
She led the way, and the Kachain Shemal were content with that. Sag Churok watched the frail, puny human taking her meager strides, leaving behind the rise where two dragons had done battle. And the Kel hunter was well pleased. He sensed, in a sweet wave, Gunthmak's pride. Pride in their destriant. Drawn by four oxen, the large wagon rolled into the camp, mobbed by mothers, husbands, wives, and children who raised their voices in ululating grief. Arms reached out as if to grab hold of their dead loved ones who lay stacked like felled bowls on the flat bed. As the burden of the slain rocked to a halt, the mob churned. Dogs howled. On a nearby hill, Setok stood watching the bedlam in the camp, the only motion from her the stirring of her weathered hair. Warriors were running back to their yurts to ready themselves for war. Although none knew the enemy's face, and there was no trail to track, would-be war leaders shouted and bellowed, beating on their own chests or waving weapons in the air. For all the grief and anger, there was something pathetic to the whole scene, something that made her turn away, suddenly weary. No one liked being a victim of the unknown. They were driven to lash out, driven to deliver indiscriminate violence upon whoever happened to be close. She could hear some of those warriors vowing vengeance upon the Akrinai, the Drasilhani, even the Lethari. The Gadra clan was going to war. War Chief Stolman was under siege in his own tent, and to deny the murderous hunger of his warriors would see him deposed bloodily. No, he would need to stand tall, drawing his Bedouin cloak about his broad shoulders, and take up his twin-bladed axe. His wife, if anything fiercer than Stallman himself, would begin painting the white mask of death, the slayer's bone grin upon her husband's scarred features. Her own mother, a wrinkled, hatchet-faced hag, would do the same to her. Edges singing on whetstones, the Barghast were going to war. She saw Cathal emerging from Stallman's tent. Even at this distance, she could read his frustration as he marched towards the largest crowd of warriors, and when his steps slowed and he finally halted, Setoc understood him well enough. He had lost the Gadra. She watched as he looked round until he caught sight of yet another solitary figure. Torrent was already saddling his horse, not to join in this madness, but to leave. As Cathal set out towards the All-Warrior, Setoc went down to meet them. Whatever words they exchanged before she arrived were terse, unsatisfying to the great warlock. He noted her approach and faced her.
"You too?"
he asked.
"I will go with you," she said. "The wolves will join none of this. It is empty."
"The Gadra mean to wage war against the Akrenai," said Cathal. "But the Akrenai have done nothing."
She nodded, reaching up to pull her long fair hair from her face as the hot wind gusted. Torrent was lifting himself onto his horse. His face was bleak, haunted. He had the look of a man who did not sleep well at night. He gathered his reins. Cathal turned to him.
"Wait, please, Torrent, wait."
The man grimaced.
"Is this to be my life? Dragged from one woman's tent to the next? Am I to rot my days away? Or do I choose instead to fight at your side? Why would I do that? You Barghast, you are no different from my own people, and you will share their fate." He nodded towards Setoc. "The wolf child is right. The scavengers of this land will grow fat."
Setoc caught a flash of something crouched behind a tuft of grass. A hare. No, Talamandas. That thing of twine and sticks. Child of the mad Barghast gods. Child of children. Spying on them. She sneered.
"But,"
asked Cathal,
"where will you go, Torrent?"
"I shall ride to Tul and beg my leave of him. I shall ask for his forgiveness, for I should have been the warrior to fall against the Lethary in defense of the All Children, not his friend, not the Mesler."
Cathal's eyes had widened at Torrent's words, and after a moment he seemed to sag.
"Ah, Torrent, Malazans have a way."
He lifted a sad smile to the All.
"They do humble us all. Tul will reject your words. There is nothing to forgive. There is no crime set against you. It was the Mesler's way, his choice."
"He rode out in my place."
The great warlock straightened.
"And could you have fared as well as he did, Torrent?"
That was a cruel question, and Setoc saw how it stung the young warrior.
"That is not the—"
"But it is,"
Cathal snapped.
"If Tok had judged you his superior in battle, he would have exhorted you to ride against the Lethary. He would have taken the children away. And if it was that Malazan sitting here on his horse before me right now, he would not be mooning about forgiveness. Do you understand me, Torrent?"
The man looked cruelly bludgeoned by Cathal's words.
"Even if it is so, I ride to Tul, and then I shall set off on my own. I have chosen. Tie no strands to my fate, great warlock."
Setoc barked a laugh.
"He is not the one to do that, Torrent."
His eyes narrowed on her. She thought he might retort, accusations, anger, bridling indignation. Instead, he said nothing, simply drawing up his reins. A last glance back to Cathal.
"You walk, but I ride. I am not interested in slowing my pace to suit you."
"And what if I told you I could travel in such a way as to reach Tul long before you will?"
"You cannot."
Setok saw the great warlock lick dry lips, saw the sweat that had appeared upon his broad, flat brow, and her heart began thudding hard in her chest.
Kafal, she said, her voice flat. This is not your land. The warrens you people speak of are weak here. I doubt you can even reach them. Your gods are not ready.
Speak not of the Barghast gods, squealed a voice.
Telamandas, the Sticksnare, scrambled out from cover and came closer in fits and starts.
You know nothing, witch.
I know enough, she replied. Yes, your kind once walked these plains. But how long ago was that? You warred with the Tist Edur. You were driven from this place. 1,000 years ago? 10,000? So now you return to avenge your ancestors. But you found the Edur nothing like your legends. Unlike you, Barghast, they had moved on.
As the victorious ever do, the Sticksnare hissed. Their wounds heal quickly. Yes, nothing festers, nothing rots. There is no bitterness on their tongues.
She spat in disbelief.
How can you say that? Their emperor is dead. They are driven from all the lands they conquered.
But not by our hands!
The shriek snatched heads round. Warriors drew closer. Kafal remained silent, his expression suddenly closed, while Torrent leaned forward on the saddle, squinting down at the Sticksnare as if doubting his own sanity. Setok smiled at Telamandas.
Yes, that is what galls, isn't it? So, now.
And she turned to face the score or so warriors half encircling them.
Now, yes, you would deliver such defeat upon the Akrenai. Wounds that will fester, rot that sinks deep into the soul, that cruel taste riding every breath.
Her tirade seemed to buffet them. She spat again.
They did not kill your scouts. You all know this, and you do not even care.
She pointed at Kafal.
And so the great warlock now goes to Tul, and he will say to him, War master, yet another clan has broken away. They wage senseless war upon the wrong enemy, and so it will come to pass that, by the actions of the Gadra clan, every people in this land will rise up against the Barghast. Akrinai, Drasilhani, Kerin, Safinand, Bolkando. You will be assailed from all sides, and those of you not killed in battle will be driven into the wastelands, that vast ocean of nothing, and there you will vanish, your bones turning to dust.
There was movement in the crowd, and warriors stepped aside as a scowling war chief Stallman lumbered forward, his wife a step behind him. That woman's eyes were dark, savage with hatred as she fixed her glare upon Setok.
This is what you do, witch, she said in a rasp. You weaken us. Again and again, you seek to weaken us.
Are you so eager to see your children die? Setok asked her.
Eager to see them win glory.
For themselves or for you, Sakara?
Sakara would have flung herself at Setok then, but Stallman held out a staying arm, knocking her back. Though he could not see it, his wife then shot him a look of venomous malice. Torrent spoke quietly to Setok.
Come with me, wolf child. We will ride out of this madness.
He reached down with one hand. She grasped hold of his forearm, and he swung her easily onto the horse's back. As she closed her arms round his waist, he said,
Do you need to collect anything, Setok, from your tent?
No.
Send them off, snarled Sakara. Go, you foreign liars, Akrinai spies. Go and poison your own kind. With terror, tell them we are coming. The white-faced Barghast. And we shall make of this land our home once again. Tell them, witch, they are the invaders, not us.
Setok had long sensed the animosity building among the women in this clan. She drew too many eyes among the men. Her wildness made them hungry, curious. She was not blind to any of this. Even so, this burst of spite startled her, frightened her. She forced herself to meet Sakara's blazing eyes.
I am the holder of 1,000 hearts.
Saying this, she looked to Sakara's husband and smiled a knowing smile. Stallman was forced to restrain his wife as she sought to lunge forward, a knife in one hand. Torrent backed his horse, and she could feel how he tensed.
"Enough of that," he snapped over his shoulder. "Do you want her skinned alive?"
The mob had grown and now surrounded them, and, she saw at last, there were far more women than men in it. She felt herself withering beneath the hateful stares fixed upon her. Not just wives, either. That she was sitting snug against Torrent was setting fires in the eyes of the younger women, the maidens. Cathal stepped closer, his face pale in dread mockery of the white paint of the warriors.
"I am going to open a warren," he said in a low voice, "with the help of Talamandas. We leave together, or you will be killed here. Do you understand? It's too late for the Gadra. Your words, Setok, held too many truths. They are shamed."
"Be quick, then,"
Torrent said in a growl. He swung round.
"Talamandas."
"Leave them to their fate,"
muttered the stick snare, crouched like a miniature ghoul. It seemed to be twitching as if plucked and prodded by unseen hands.
"No, all of us."
"You will regret your generosity, Cathal."
"The warren, Talamandas."
The stick snare snarled wordlessly and then straightened, spreading wide its scrawny twig arms.
"Cathal!"
hissed Setok.
"Wait! There is a sickness!"
White fire erupted around them in a sudden deafening roar. The horse screamed, reared. Setok's grip broke and she tumbled back, searing heat, stunning cold. As quickly as the flames arrived, they vanished with a thunderous clap that reverberated in her skull. A kick from a hoof sent her skidding, pain throbbing from a bruised thigh. There was darkness now, or, she thought with a shock, she was blind. Her eyes curdled in their sockets, cooked like eggs. Then she caught a glimmer, something smeared, a reflected blade. Torrent's horse was backing, twisting from side to side. The all-warrior still rode the beast, and she could hear him cursing as he fought to steady the animal. He had drawn his scimitar.
"Gods below!"
That cry had come from Cathal. Setok sat up, stony, damp earth, clumps of mold or guano squishing beneath her. She smelled burning grasses. Crawling to the vague blot in the gloom whence came the warlock's voice, she struggled against waves of nausea.
"You fool,"
she croaked.
"You should have listened, Cathal."
"Talamandas, he's destroyed."
The stench of something smouldering was stronger now, and she caught the gleam of scattered embers.
"He burned? He burned, didn't he? The wrong warren. It ate him, devoured him. I warned you, Cathal. Something has infected your warrens."
"No, Setok,"
Cathal cut in.
"It is not like that. Not like what you say. We knew of that poison. We were warded against it. This was different. Spirits fend. We have lost our greatest shaman."
"You did not know it, did you? That gate. It was unlike anything you've ever known, wasn't it? Listen to me. It is what I have been trying to tell you."
They heard Torrent dismount, his moccasins thudding on the yielding, strangely soft ground.
"Be quiet, both of you. Argue what happened later. Listen to the echoes. I think we are trapped inside a cavern."
"Well,"
said Setok, carefully climbing to her feet,
"there must be a way out."
"How do you know that?"
"Because there's bats."
"But I have my damned horse. Cathal, take us somewhere else."
"I cannot."
"What?"
"The power belonged to Talamandas. A binding of agreements, promises, with countless human gods. With Hood, Lord of Death. The Barghast gods are young, too young. I cannot even sense them. I am sorry. I do not know where we are."
"I am cursed to follow fools!"
Setok flinched at the anguish in that shout.
"Poor Torrent. You just wanted to leave there, to ride out, away.
Your stupid sense of honor demanded you visit Tul, and now look!
No one spoke for a time, the only sounds their breathing and anxious snorts from the horse. Setok sought to sense some flow of air, but there was nothing. Her thigh aching, she sank back down. She then chose a direction at random and crawled. The guano thickened so that her hands plunged through up to her wrists, and then she found a stone barrier. Wiping the mess from her hands, she tracked with her fingers.
Wait! These stones are set! I've found a wall!
Scrabbling sounds behind her, and then the scratch of flint and iron. Sparks, actinic flashes, and then a burgeoning glow. Moments later, Torrent had a taper lit and was setting the flame to the wick of a small camp lantern. The chamber took shape around them. The entire cavern was constructed of set stones, the ones overhead massive, wedged in place in seemingly precipitous disorder. In seething patches here and there clung bats, chittering and squeaking now in agitation.
"Look there!"
Cafal pointed. The bats were converging on a conjoining of ill-set stones, wriggling into cracks.
"There's the way out!"
Torrent's laugh was bitter.
"We are entombed! One day looters will break in, find the bones of two men, a child and a damned horse. For us to ride into the death world, or so they might think. Then again, they might wonder at the gnaw marks on all but one set of bones, and at the scratchings and gougings on the stone. Tiny bat bones and heaps of dried-out scat.
Crush that imagination of yours, Torrent," advised Cafal. "Though the way out is nothing but cracks, we know the world outside is close. We need only dig our way out."
"This is a stone barrow or something much like it, Cafal. If we start dragging stones loose, the whole thing is likely to come down on us."
"We have no choice."
He walked over to the wall where the bats had swarmed through moments earlier. Drawing a dagger, he began probing. A short time later, Torrent joined him, using his hunter's knife. To the sounds of scraping and sifting earth, Setok sat down closer to the lantern. Memories of that white fire haunted her. Her head ached as if the heat had seared parts of her brain, leaving blank patches that pulsed behind her eyes. She could hear no muted howls. The wolves were lost to her in this place.
"What world have we found? What waits beyond these stone walls? Does a sun shine out there? Does it blaze with death? Or is this a realm forever dark, lifeless? Well, someone built this place, but if this is indeed a barrow, where are the bones?"
She picked up the lantern, wincing at the hot handle which had not been tilted to one side. Gingerly rising, she played the light over the damp, mottled ground at her feet. Guano, a few stones dislodged from above. If there had ever been a body interred in this place, it had long since rotted down to crumbs. And it had not been adorned with jewelry, no buckles nor clasps to evince clothing of any sort.
"This," she ventured, "is probably thousands of years old. There's nothing left of whoever was buried here."
A muted mutter from Torrent, answered by a grunt from Cafal, who then glanced back at her.
"Where we're digging, Setok, someone has been through this way before. If this is a barrow, it's been long since looted, emptied out."
"Since when does loot include the corpse itself?"
"The guano is probably acidic," Cafal said. "It probably dissolved the bones. The point is, we can dig our way out, and it's not likely everything will collapse down on us."
"Don't be so sudden of that," Torrent said. "We need to make a hole big enough to get my horse out. The looters had no need to be so ambitious."
"You had best prepare yourself for the notion of killing your mount," Cafal said.
"No, she is an all-horse, the last all-horse, and she is mine. No, we belong to each other, both alone. If she must die, then I will die with her. Let this barrow be our home in the death world."
"You have a morbid cast of mind," Cafal said.
He has earned the right,
Setok murmured, still scanning the ground as she walked a slow circuit.
Ah!
She bent down, retrieved a small half-encrusted object.
A coin. Copper.
She scraped the green disc clean and held it close to the lantern.
I recognized nothing. Not Lethary, nor Balkando.
Kafal joined her.
Permit me, Setok. My clan was in the habit of collecting coins to make our armor. It was his damned hauberk of coins that dragged my father to the sea bottom.
She handed it to him. He studied it for a long time, one side, then the other, over and over, and finally sighed and handed it back.
No, some empress, I imagine, looking so regal. The crossed swords on the other side could be seven cities, but the writing is all wrong. This is not our world, Setok.
I didn't think it was.
Done with that, Kafal?
Torrent asked from where he worked at the wall, impatience giving an edge to his tone. Kafal offered her a wry smile and then returned to Torrent's side. A loud scrape followed by a heavy thud and cool, dew-heavy air flowed into the chamber.
Smell that? It's a damned forest!
At Kafal's words, Setok joined them. She held up the lantern.
Night, cool, cooler than the Aldan. Trees, she said,
peering at the ragged boles faintly visible in the light. There was possibly a bog out there. She could hear frogs.
If it was night, Torrent wondered, what were the bats doing inside here?
Perhaps it was only nearing dusk when we arrived, or dawn is but moments away.
Kafal tugged at another stone.
Help me with this one, he said to Torrent. It's too heavy for one man. Setok, please, stand back. Give us room.
As they dragged the huge stone free, other rough-hewn boulders tumbled down. A large lintel stone ground its way loose, and both men leapt back as it crashed onto the rubble. Clouds of dust billowed, and a terrible grating groan sounded from the barrow's ceiling. Coughing, Kafal waved at Setok.
Quickly, out!
She scrambled over the stones, eyes stinging, and staggered outside. Three paces, and then she turned about. She heard the thump of stones from the ceiling. The horse shrilled in pain. From the gaping entrance, Kafal appeared, followed a moment later by Torrent, who had somehow brought his mount down onto its knees. He held the reins, and with rapid twitches on them, he urged his horse forward, its head thrust into view, eyes flashing in the reflected lantern light. Setok had never before seen a horse crawl. She had not thought it even possible. But here this mare was lurching through the gap, sheathed in dust and streaks of sweat. More rocks tumbled behind the beast, and she squealed in pain, lunging, forelimbs scrabbling as she lifted herself up from the front end. Moments after the animal finally lumbered clear, the moss-humped roof of the barrow collapsed in thunder and dust. Decades-old trees that had grown upon it toppled in a thrash of branches and leaves. Wood splintered. Blood streamed from the mare's haunches. Torrent had calmed the beast once more and was tending to the gashes.
Not so bad, he muttered. Had she broken a hip?
Setok saw that the warrior was trembling. This bond he had forged with his hapless mare stood in place of all those ties that had been so cruelly severed from his young life, and it was fast becoming something monstrous.
If she must die, then I will die with her.
Madness, Torrent. It's a damned horse, a dumb beast with its spirit broken by bit and rein. If she'd a broken hip or leg, we'd eat well this day.
She watched Kafal observing the awl for a time, before he turned away and scanned the forest surrounding them. Then he lifted his eyes to the heavens.
No moons, he said, and the stars seem hazy. There's not enough of them. No constellations I recognize.
There are no wolves here.
He faced her.
They're ghosts, yes, but none living. They last ran here centuries past. Centuries.
Well, there's deer scat and trails, so they didn't starve to death.
No, hunted.
She hugged herself.
Tell me the mind of those who would kill every last wolf, who would choose to never again hear their mournful howls, or to see, with a shiver, a pack standing proud on a rise. Great warlock, explain this to me, for I do not understand.
He shrugged.
We hate rivals, Setok. We hate seeing the knowing burn in their eyes. You have not seen civilized lands. The animals go away, and they never return. They leave silence, and that silence is filled with the chatter of our kind. Given the ability, we kill even the night.
His eyes fell to the lantern in her hand. Scowling, she doused it. In the sudden darkness, Torrent cursed.
That does not help, Wolfchild. We light fires, but the darkness remains in our minds. Cast light within, and you will not like what you see.
A part of her wanted to weep for the ghosts, for herself.
We need to find a way home.
Cathal sighed.
There is power here. Unfamiliar. Even so, perhaps I can make use of it. I sense it fragmented, shredded. It has, I think, not been used in a long, long time.
He looked round.
I must clear a space, sanctify it.
Even without Telemandus? Torrent asked.
He would have been of little help here,
Cathal replied.
His bindings all severed.
He glanced at Setok.
You, Wolfchild, can help.
How?
Summon the wolf ghosts.
No.
The thought made her feel wretched.
I can give them nothing in return.
Perhaps a way through, into another world, even our own, where they will find living kin, where they will run unseen shoulder to shoulder with them, and remember the hunt, old loyalties, sparks of love.
She eyed him.
Is such a thing possible?
I don't know, but let us try. I do not like this world. Even in this forest, the air is tainted, foul. We have most of the night ahead of us. Let us do what we can to be gone before the sun rises, before we are discovered.
Sanctify your ground, then, Setok said.
She walked off into the wood, sat down upon the mossy trunk of a fallen tree. No, a tree that had been cut down, cleanly. No axe could have managed such level precision. Why, then, had it been simply left here?
There is madness here,
she whispered. Closing her eyes, she sought to drive the bleak thoughts away.
Ghosts, wolves, listen to my mind's howl. Hear the sorrow, the anger. Hear my promise. I will guide you from this infernal realm. I will find you kin, kin of hot blood, warm fur, the cry of newborn pups, the snarl of rival males. I will show you grasslands, my children, vistas unending.
And she felt them, the beasts that had fallen in pain and grief here in this very forest so long, long ago. The first to come to her was the last survivor of that time, the last to be cornered and viciously slain. She heard the echo of snarling hounds, the cries of human voices. She felt the wolf's terror, its despair, its helpless bemusement. She felt as well, as the beast's lifeblood spilled into the churned-up soil, its surrender, its understanding, in that final moment, that its terrible loneliness was at last coming to an end. And her mind howled anew, a silent cry that nevertheless sent rooks thrashing from tree branches in raucous flight, that froze deer and hares in their tracks, as some ancient terror within them was stirred to life. Howls answered her, closing from all sides.
Come to me, gather all that remains of your power.
She could hear thrashing in the brush, as will and memory alone bulled through the bracken. And she sensed, with a shock, more than one species. Some dark, black-furred and low to the ground, eyes blazing yellow, others tall at the shoulders, rangy, with ebon-tipped silver fur, and she saw their ancestors, even larger beasts, short-nosed, massively muscled. They came in multitudes beyond comprehension, and each bore their death wounds, the shafts of spears jutting from throat and flank, blood-gushing punctures streaming from chest, snares and traps clanking and dragging from broken limbs. Bloated from poison, she saw with mounting horror a legacy of such hateful, spiteful slaughter that she cried out, a shriek tearing at her own throat. Torrent was shouting, fighting to control his panicked horse as wolf ghosts flooded in, thousands, hundreds of thousands. This was an old world, and here before her, crowding close with need, was the toll amassed by its insane victors, its triumphant tyrants. Oh, there were other creatures as well, caught in the rushing tide, beasts long since crumbled to dust. She saw stags, bedarin, large cats. She saw huge furred beasts with broad heads and horns jutting from black snouts.
So many gods, so many!
Setok, stop! The power! It is too great! It overwhelms!
But she had lost all control. She had not expected anything like this. The pressure, crushing in from all sides now, threatened to destroy her. She wept like the last child on earth, the last living thing, sole witness to the legacy of all that her kind had achieved. This desolation, this suicidal victory over nature itself.
Setok!
All at once she saw something glowing before her, a portal, pathetically small, nothing more than a bolt hole. She raised a trembling hand and pointed towards it.
My loved ones, she whispered, the way through. Make it bigger.
They had wandered far beyond the chamber of slaughter, where scores of Kachane Jemal had seemingly been sacrificed. Lanterns cast fitful light against metal entrails embedded in niches along the walls of the corridors, and from the ceiling thick cables sagged, dripping some kind of viscous oil. The air was rank with acidic vapors, making their eyes water. Side passages opened to rooms crowded with strange, incomprehensible machinery, the floor slick with spilled oils. Taxilian led the others in their exploration, wending ever deeper into the maze of wide, low-ceilinged corridors. Moving a step behind him, Rortos could hear the man muttering, but he could not make out the words. He feared Taxilian might be going mad. This was an alien world, shaped by alien minds. Sense and understanding eluded them all, and from this was born fear. Behind Rortos, almost on his heels, was breath, coughing, gasping, as if her endless talk of drowning had thickened the air around her.
Tunnels!
She hissed.
I hate tunnels. Pits, caves, dark, always dark rooms. Where is he leading us? We've passed countless ramps leading to higher levels. What is the fool looking for?
Rortos had no answers, so he said nothing. Behind breath, Sheb and Napet were bickering. Those two would come to blows soon. They were too much alike. Both vicious, both fundamentally amoral, both born betrayers. Rortos wished they would kill each other. They would not be missed.
Ah,
cried Taxilian.
Found it!
Rortos moved up to the man's side. They stood at the threshold of a vast eight-walled chamber. A narrow ledge encircled it level with the passage they had just traversed. The actual floor was lost in darkness below. Taxilian edged out to the right, lifting his lantern. A monstrous mechanism filling the center of the expanse towered past level after level. Only a few with balconies to match the one they were on, until it vanished high overhead. It seemed to be constructed entirely of metal, gleaming like brass and the purest iron, eight cylinders, each the size of a city tower. Spigots jutted out from bolted collars that fastened the segments every second level, and attached to these were black, pliant ropes of some sort that reached out like the strands of an abandoned spider's web, converging on huge boxes of metal affixed to the walls. Peering downward, Rortos could just make out a change in the configuration of the towers, as if each one sat upon a beehive dome. His gaze caught and held upon one piece of metal, bent so perfectly between two fittings, and he frowned as if silts had been brushed from some deeply submerged memory. He groped towards it, fighting back a whimper, and then the blinding clouds returned, and he was swept away once more. He reeled and would have fallen from the ledge had not breath roughly pulled him back.
"Idiot, do you want to kill yourself?"
He shook his head.
"Sorry, thank you."
"Don't bother. I acted on instinct. If I'd thought about it, I probably would have let you go. You're nothing to me, fat old man. Nothing. No one is. Not here. Not one of you."
She had raised her voice to make certain everyone else heard her last words. Sheb snorted.
"Bitch needs a lesson or two, I think."
Breath spun to face him.
"Hungry for a curse, are you? What part of your body do you want to rot off first? Maybe I'll do the choosing."
"Set your magic on me, woman, and I will throttle you."
She laughed, turned away.
"Play with Asana if you have the need."
Rortos, after a few deep, calming breaths, set out after Taxilian, who had begun walking round the ledge, eyes fixed on the edifice.
"It's an engine," he said when Rortos drew close.
"A what? As in a mill? But I see nothing like gears or..."
"Like that, yes. You can hide gears and levers inside, in housings to keep them clean of grit and whatnot. Even more relevantly, you can seal things and make use of alternating pressures, and so move things from one place to another. It's a common practice in alchemy, especially if one conjures such pressures using heat and cold. I once saw a sorcerous invention that could draw the ether out of a glass jar, thus quenching the lit candle within it. A pump bound in wards was used to draw out the life force that exists in the air."
He waved one hand at the towers.
"Heat, cold. I think these are vast pressure chambers of some sort."
"For what purpose?"
Taxilian looked at him with glittering eyes.
"That's what I mean to find out."
There were no ladders or bridges across to the towers. Taxilian led him back to the entranceway.
"We're going up now," he said. "We need food," said Last, his expression worried, frightened. "We could get lost in here."
"Stop whimpering," growled Nappet. "I could walk us out of here in no time."
"None of you," cut in Asana, startling everyone, "wants to talk about what we found in the first room. That's what you're all running from. Those monsters, they were all slaughtered."
She glared at them, diffident, and rushed on.
"What killed them could still be here. We don't know anything about any of this."
"Those monsters didn't die in battle," said Sheb. "That was a ritual killing we saw. Sacrifices, that's what they were."
"Maybe they had no choice,"
Sheb snorted.
"I can't think of many beasts choosing to be sacrificed. Of course they had no choice. This place is abandoned. You can feel it. Smell it in the stale air."
"When we climb higher," said Last, "we'll get out of the wet, and we can see if there's tracks in the dust."
"Gods below, the farmer's good for something after all," said Nappet with a hard grin.
"Let's go then," said Taxilian, and he set off.
Once more the others fell in behind him. Drifting between all of them, voiceless, half-blinded with sorrow that swept down like curtains of rain, the ghost yearned to reach through. To Taxilian, Rortos, even stolid, slow-thinking Last. In their journey through the bowels of the Dragon Keep, knowledge had erupted, thunderous, pounding concussions that sent him reeling. He knew this place. He knew its name. Kals Rooted. A domain of the K'chain Shemal, a border keep. A vast body now drained of all life, a corpse standing empty-eyed on the plain. And he knew that a Shigal assassin had slain those Kel hunters to seal the failure of this fortress.
Defeat was approaching. The whispering chant, the song of scales. The great army sent out from here had been annihilated. Naught but a pathetic rearguard left behind. The Jan sentinels would have taken the matron away to the field of the fallen, there to entomb her forevermore. Taxilian, hear me. What is lifeless is not necessarily dead. That which falls can rise again. Take care, take great care in this place.
But his cries were not heard. He was trapped outside, made helpless with all that he understood, with this cascade of secrets that could do little more than tumble into an abyss of ignorance. He knew how Asana railed in her own mind, how she longed to escape her own flesh. She wanted out from all that had failed her, her damned flesh, her dying organs, her very mind. She had been awakened to the comprehension that the body was a prison, but one prone to terrible, inexorable decay. Oh, there was always that final flight, when the corroded bars ceased to pose a barrier, when the soul was free to fly, to wing out in search of unseen shores. But with that release, for all she knew, all that she called herself would be lost. Asana would end, cease, and that which was born from the ashes held no regard for the living left behind, no regard for that world of aches, pain, and suffering. It was transformed into indifference, and all that was past, all that belonged to the mortal life now done, meant nothing to it. She could not comprehend such a cruel rebirth. She longed for death nonetheless, longed to escape her withered husk with all its advancing decrepitude, its sundering into the pathos of the broken. Fear alone held her back, back from that ledge in the eight-sided chamber, back from that fatal drop to some unseen floor far below. And that same fear clawed at her now. Demons stalked this keep. She dreaded what was coming. Walking a step behind her was Last, aptly choosing a rearguard position. His shoulders were hunched, head ducked as if the corridor's ceiling were much lower than it was. He was a man born to open spaces, boundless skies overhead, the sweep of vistas. Within this haunted maze, he felt diminished, almost crippled. Vertigo lunged at him with each turn and twist. He saw how the walls closed in. He felt the mass looming over them all, the unbearable weight of countless stories overhead. He had a sudden memory of his childhood. He had been helping his father before the debts arrived, before everything was taken away that meant anything at all. He had been helping his father, he recalled, dismantle a shed behind the stables. They had prized loose the warped planks and were stacking them in a disordered heap this side of the pen's fence, finishing a task begun months earlier, before the planting. By late afternoon, the shed was down, and his father had told him to rearrange the boards, sorting them by length and condition. He had set to the task. Recollection grew hazy then, up until the moment he lifted a grey, weathered plank, one from last season's work, and saw how its recent shifting from the day's work just done had crushed a nest of mice, a woven bundle of grasses flattened, smeared in a tangle of blood and tiny entrails. Hairless pink pups scattered about, crushed, each one yielding up their single drop of lifeblood. Both parents suffocated beneath the weight of the overburden. Kneeling before this tableau, his presence looming like a god come too late, he stared down at this destroyed family. Silly to weep, of course. There were plenty of other mice. Erin knew the yard's cats stayed fat. So foolish, these tears. Yes, he'd been just a child. A sensitive age, no doubt. And later that night his father took him by the hand and led him out to the modest barrow on the old plot, continuing what had been their post-supper ritual ever since his mother was put into the ground. And they burned knotted hoops of wrinkled grass with their dried blossoms that flared bright the instant flames touched them. Bursts of fire that blotted the eyes with pulsing afterglows. And when his father saw the tears on his son's cheeks, he drew him close and said,
"I've been waiting for that."
Yes, the levels above seemed well built, the walls solid and sturdy. No reason to think it would all come down at the careless toss of some child god. These kinds of thoughts, well, they could only make a man angry, in ways every child would understand. He walked with his huge hands balled into fists. Sheb was fairly certain that he had died in prison, or come close enough to dead that the cell cutter simply ordered the bearers to carry him out to the lime pits, and they spilled him down onto a bed of dusted corpses. Searing pain from the lime had roused him from his fevered oblivion, and he must have climbed his way out, pushed through the bodies that had been dumped on top of him. He recalled struggling, vast, unshifting weights. He recalled even thinking that he had failed, that he was too weak, that he would never get free. He even remembered seeing swaths of red, blistered skin on his arms, sloughing away in his frenzied thrashing, and a nightmare instant where he gouged out his own burning eyes to bring an end to their agony. Mad delusions, of course. He had won free. Had he not, would he be alive now, walking at Napet's side? No, he had cheated them all. Those Hivana agents who brought the embezzlement charges against him, the advocates who bribed him out of the drownings, where, he knew, he would have survived, seeing him instead sent to the work camps, 10 years hard labor. No one survived that. Except me, Sheb the Unkillable. And one day, Xeranthos, Hivana, I will come back to steal the rest of your wealth. I still know what I know, don't I? And you will pay to keep me quiet. And this time round, I won't get careless. I'll see your corpse lying in a pauper's pit. I swear it before the errant himself. I swear it. Walking at Sheb's side, Napet held on to his cold, hard grin. He knew Sheb wanted to be the bully in this crowd. The man had a viper's heart, a stony knuckle of a thing beating out venom in turgid spurts. One of these nights, he vowed, he'd throw the fool on his back and give him the old snake head where it counted. Sheb had been in a lethary prison. Napet was certain of it. His habits, his manners, his skittish way of moving, they told him all he needed to know about ratty little Sheb. He'd been used and used well in those cells. Calluses on the knees, fish breath, slick cheeks. There were plenty of names for men like him. Sheb had got it enough to start liking it. And all this bitching back and forth between Napet and Sheb, well, that was just seeing who'd be the first one doing the old cat stretch. 4 years back-breaking quarrying up near Blue Rose. That had been Napet's sentence for that little gory mess back in Letharus. The sister's husband who'd liked throwing the frail thing around. Well, no brother was going to let that just sidle past. No brother worth anything. The only damned shame was that he hadn't managed to kill the bastard. Close, though. Enough broken bones so that the man had trouble sitting up, never mind stalking the house, breaking things and hitting defenseless women. Not that she'd been grateful. Family loyalty only went one way, it turned out. He forgave her quick enough for ratting on him. She'd walked in on a messy scene, after all. Screams aplenty. Her poor mind was confused. She'd never been very sharp to begin with. If she had been, why, she'd never have married that nub-nosed, swaggering turd in the first place. Anyway, Napet knew he'd get Sheb sooner or later, so long as Sheb understood that between them he was the man in charge. And he knew that Sheb would want it rough, at least to start with, so he could look outraged, wounded and all that. The two of them, they'd played in the same yard, after all. Breath stumbled and Napet shoved her forward.
Stupid woman. Frail and stupid, that's what you are, like every other woman. Almost as bad as the hag back there. You got a swamp drying out in that blonde hair, did you know that? You stink of the swamp. Not that we've been through one.
She shot him a glare before hurrying on. Breath could smell mud. Its stench seemed to ooze from her pores. Napet was right in that. But that didn't stop her thinking about ways to kill him. If not for Taxilian, and maybe last, he and Sheb would have raped her by now. Once or twice, to convince her about who was in charge. After that, she knew, they'd be happy enough with each other. She'd been told a story once, although she could not recall who had told it to her, or where they had been. It was a tale about a girl who was a witch, though she didn't know it yet. She was a seer of the tiles long before she saw her first tile. a gift no one thought to even look for in this small wheat-haired child. Even before her first blood flow, men had been after her. Not the tall, grey-skinned ones, though the girl feared them the most, for reasons never explained, but men living in the same place as her. Lethary, slaves, yes, slaves, just like she'd been. That girl, that witch. And there was one man, maybe the only one among them all, who did not look on her with hunger. No, in his eyes there had been love. That real thing, that genuine thing that girls dreamed of finding. But he was low-born, he was nothing. A mender of nets, a man whose red hands shed fish scales when he returned from his day's work. The tragedy was this, then. The girl had not yet found her tiles. Had she done so early enough, she would have taken that man to her bed. She would have made him her first man. So that what was born between her legs was not born in pain. So that it would not become so dark in its delicious desires. Before the tiles, then, she had given herself to other men, unloving men. She'd given herself over to be used. The same men who then in turn gave her a new name, one born of the legend of the White Crow, who once offered the gift of flight to humans in the form of a single feather. And, urged on by promises, men would grasp hold of that feather and seek to fly, only to fall to their deaths, with the crow laughing as they fell. Crows needed to eat just like everything else, after all.
I am the White Crow, and I will feed on your dreams, and feed well.
They called her Feather for the promise she offered and never delivered. Had she found the tiles, breath was certain, she would have been given a different name, that little blonde girl, whoever she was. Rortos, who had yet to discover his family name, was thinking of his wife, trying to recall something of their lives together, something other than the disgusting misery of their last years. A man does not marry a girl, nor a woman. He marries a promise, and it shines with a bright purity that is ageless. It shines, in other words, with the glory of lies. The deception is self-inflicted. The promise was simple in its form, as befitted the thick-headedness of young men, and in its essence it offered the delusion that the present moment was eternal, that nothing would change. Not the fires of desire, not the flesh itself, not the intense look in the eye. Now here he was, at the far end of a marriage, where she was at this moment he had no idea. Perhaps he'd murdered her. Perhaps, as was more likely, given the cowardice in his soul, he had simply fled her. No matter, he could look back with appalling clarity now and see how her dissolution had matched his own. They had each settled like a lump of wax, melting season by season, descending into something shapeless, something not even hinting at the forms they had once possessed. Smeared, sagging, two heaps of sour smells, chafed skin, groans born of fitful motion. Fools that they both were, they had not moved through the years hand in hand. No, they'd not possessed that wisdom, that ironic recognition of the inevitable. Neither had mitigated their youthful desires with the limits imposed so cruelly by age. He had dreamed of finding a younger woman, someone nubile, soft, unblemished. She had longed for a tall, sturdy benefactor to soften her bedding with romance and delight her with the zealotry of the enchanted. They had won nothing for all their desires except misery and loneliness.
Like two burlap sacks filled with tarnished baubles, each squatting alone in its own room, in dust and cobwebs. We stopped talking. No, be truthful, we never talked. Oh, past each other often enough in those early years. Yes, we talked past each other, avid and sharp, too humourless to be wry, fools that we were. Could we have learned how to laugh back then? So much might have turned out differently. So much. Regrets and coin, the debt ever mounts.
This nightmarish keep was the perfect match to the frightening chaos in his mind. Incomprehensible workings, gargantuan machines, corridors and strange ramps leading upward to the next levels, mysteries on all sides, as if, as if Rortos was losing his sense of himself, was losing talents he had long taken for granted. How could knowledge collapse so quickly? What was happening to him? Could the mind sink into a formless, unstructured thing to match the flesh that held it? Perhaps, he thought with a start, he had not fled at all. Instead, he was lying on his soft bed, eyes open but seeing nothing of the truth, whilst his soul wandered the maze of a broken brain. The thought horrified Rortos, and he physically picked up his pursuit of Taxilian until he trod on the man's heel. At Lance back, brows raised. Rortos mumbled an apology, wiped sweat from his jowly face. Taxilian returned his attention to this steep ramp before him, and the landing he could now see ahead and above. The air was growing unbearably warm. He suspected there were chutes and vents that moved currents of warmth and cold throughout this alien city, but as yet he'd found none, not a single grated opening, and there were no drafts flowing past. If currents flowed in this air, they were so muted, so constrained, that human skin could not sense their whispering touch. The city was dead, and yet it lived, it breathed, and somewhere a heart beat a slow syncopation, a heart of iron and brass, of copper and acrid oil. Valves and gears, rods and hinges, collars and rivets. He had found the lungs, and he knew that in one of the levels still awaiting them he would find the heart. Then, higher still, into the dragon's skull, where slept the massive mind. All his life, dreams had filled his thoughts, his inner world, that played as would a god, maker of impossible inventions, machines so complex, so vast, they would strike like bolts of lightning should a mortal mind suddenly comprehend them. Creations to carry people across great distances, swifter than any horse or ship. Others that could surround a human soul, preserve its every thought and sense, its very knowledge of itself, and keep it all safe beyond the failing of mortal flesh. Creations to end all hunger, all poverty, to crush avarice before it was born, to cast out cruelty and indifference, to defy every inequity and deny the lure of sadistic pleasure. Moral constructs, oh, they were a madman's dreams, to be sure. Humans insisted on others behaving properly, but rarely forced the same standards upon themselves. Justifications dispensed with logic, thriving on opportunism and delusions of pious propriety. As a child, he had heard tales of heroes, tall, stern-faced adventurers who claimed the banners of honor and loyalty, of truthfulness and integrity. And yet, as the tales spun out, Taxilian would find himself assailed by a growing horror, as the great hero slashed and murdered his way through countless victims, all in pursuit of whatever he, and the world, deemed a righteous goal. His justice was sharp, but it bore but one edge, and the effort of the victims to preserve their lives was somehow made sordid, even evil. But a moral machine, ah, would it not be forced by mechanics alone to hold itself to the same standard it set upon every other sentient entity? Immune to hypocrisy, its rule would be absolute and absolutely just. A young man's dreams, assuredly. Such a machine, he now knew, would quickly conclude that the only truly just act was the thorough annihilation of every form of intelligent life in every realm known to it. Intelligence was incomplete. Perhaps it always would be. It was flawed. It could not distinguish its own lies from its own truths. Upon the scale of the self, they often weighed the same. Mistakes and malice were arguments of intent alone, not effect. There would always be violence, catastrophe, short-sighted stupidity, incompetence and belligerence. The meat of history, after all, was the fly-blown legacy of such things. And yet,
the dragon is home to a city, the city that lives when not even echoes survive to walk its streets. Its very existence is a salutation.
Taxilian believed, well, he so wanted to believe, that he would discover an ancient truth in this place. He would come, yes, face to face with a moral construct. And as for Asana's words earlier, her fretting on the slaughtered Kachain Jemal in the first chamber, such a scene made sense now to Taxilian. The machine mind had come to its inevitable conclusion. it had delivered the only possible justice. If only he could awaken it once more, perfection would return to the world. Taxilian could sense nothing, of course, of the ghost's horror at such notions. Justice without compassion was the destroyer of morality, a slayer blind to empathy.
Leave such things to nature, to the forces not even the gods can control. If you must hold to a faith, Taxilian, then hold to that one. Nature may be slow to act, but it will find a balance. And that is a process not one of us can stop, for it belongs to time itself.
And, the ghost now knew, he had a thing about time. They came upon vast chambers crowded with vats in which grew fungi and a host of alien plants that seemed to need no light. They stumbled upon seething nests of scaled rats, orthon, that scattered squealing from the lantern's harsh light. Dormitories in rows upon rows, assembly halls and places of worship, work stalls and low-ceilinged expanses given over to arcane manufacture, stacks of metal, each one identical, proof of frightening precision. Armories bearing ranks of strange weapons, warehouses with stacked packages of foodstuffs, ice rooms filled with butchered frozen meat hanging from hooks, niches in which were stored bolts of cloth, leather, and scaled hides, rooms cluttered with gourds arranged on shelves. A city, indeed, awaiting them. And still Taxilian led them ever upward, like a man possessed. A riot had erupted. Armed camps of islanders raged back and forth along the shoreline, while mobs plunged into the forests, weapons slick and dripping into the makeshift settlements, conducting pathetic looting and worse among the poorest refugees. Murder, rapes, and everywhere flames lifting orange light into the air. Before dawn, the fires had ignited the forest, and hundreds more died in smoke and heat. Jan Tovis had drawn her sheikh down onto the stony shoreline, where numbers alone kept the worst of the killers at bay. The ex-prisoners of Second Maiden Fort had not taken well the rumour, sadly accurate, that the Queen of Twilight was preparing to lead them into an unknown world, a realm of darkness, a road without end. That, if she failed and lost her way, would find them all abandoned, trapped forever in a wasteland that had never known a sun's light, a sun's blessed warmth. A few thousand islanders had taken refuge among the sheikh. The rest, she knew, were busy dying or killing each other amidst grey smoke and raging flames. Standing facing the ravaged slope with its morbid tree stumps and destroyed huts, her face smeared with ash and sweat, her eyes streaming from the smoke, Jan Tovis struggled to find her courage, her will to take command once more. She was exhausted, in her bones and in her soul. Waves of ash-filled heat gusted against her. Distant screams drifted through the air, cutting through the surly growl of the motley rabble edging ever closer. Someone was pushing through the crowd behind her, snarling curses and dire warnings. A moment later, Squish scrambled forward.
"There's near 1,000 gulping down over there, Queen. When they get their nerve, they're gonna carve into us. We got a line of ex-guards and the like betwixt them and us. You better do something and do it fast, Highness."
She could hear renewed fighting somewhere down the beach. Twilight frowned. Something about that sound.
"Do you hear that?" she asked the witch, cowering at her side.
"What?"
"That's an organized advance, Squish."
And she pushed past the old woman, making her way towards that steady clash of iron, the shouts of commands being given, the shrieks and cries of dying looters. Even in the uncertain flickering light from the forest fire, she could see how the mob was curling back. A wedge of leathery soldiers was pushing through, drawing ever closer. Twilight halted.
"Yedan Derek and his troop. My brother, damn him!"
She saw her ex-guards shift uneasily as the wedge cut through the last looters. They did not know if the newcomers would attack them next. If they did, the poorly armed islanders would be cut to pieces. Twilight hurried, determined to throw herself between the two forces. She heard Yedan snap an order and saw the perfect precision of his 30 or so soldiers wheeling round, the wedge dispersing, flattening out to form a new line facing the churning crowd of looters, locking shields, drawing up their weapons. The threat from that direction was now over. Actual numbers were irrelevant. Discipline among a few could defeat a multitude. That was Lethary doctrine, borne out in countless battles against wild tribes on the borderlands. Yan Tovis knew it, as did her brother. She pushed through her island guard, seeing the loose relief on the faces that swung to her, the sudden deliverance from certain death. Yedan, blackened with soot and spatters of blood, must have seen her before she spied him, for he stepped into her path, lifting his helm's cheek guards, revealing his black beard, the bunching muscles of his jaw.
"My queen," he said, "dawn fast approaches. The moment of the watch is almost past. You will lose the darkness."
He hesitated and then said,
"I do not believe we can survive another day in this uprising."
"Of course we can't, you infuriating bastard!"
"The road to Galan, my queen. If you will open the way, it must be now."
He gestured with a gauntleted hand.
"When they see the portal born, they will try for it, to escape the flames, to escape the retribution of the kingdom. You will have 2,000 criminals rushing on your heels."
"And what is there to do about it?"
Even as she asked, she knew how he would answer, knew and wanted to scream.
"Queen, my soldiers will hold the portal."
"And be slaughtered!"
He said nothing, muscles knotted rhythmically beneath his beard.
"Damn you! Damn you!"
"Unveil the road, my queen."
She spun to her two captains among the ex-prison guards.
"Pithy, brevity! Support Yedan Derig's soldiers for as long as you can, but be sure not to get so entangled that your people cannot withdraw. I want you through the gate, do you understand?"
"We shall do as you say, Highness,"
Brevity replied. Yan Tovis studied the two women, wondering yet again why the others had elected them as their captains. They'd never been soldiers, anyone could see that. Damned criminals, in fact. Yet they could command. Shaking her head, she faced her brother once more.
"Will you follow us?"
"If we can, my queen. But we must be certain to hold until we see the portal way failing."
He paused, and then added with his usual terseness,
"It will be close."
Yan Tovis wanted to tear at her hair.
"Then I begin, and..."
She hesitated.
"I will talk to Pulley and Squish. I will..."
"Do not defend what I have done, sister. The time to lead is now. Go, do what must be done."
"Gods, you pompous idiot. Don't die, damn you. Don't you dare die."
She did not know if he heard her sob as she rushed away. He dropped his cheek guards once more. Besides, those helms blunted all but the sharpest sounds.
"The road to Galan, the road home. Ever leading me to wonder, why did we leave in the first place? What drove us from Galan? The first shoreline? What so fouled the water that we could no longer live there?"
She reached the ancient shell midden where she and the witches had sanctified the ground, climbed achingly, raw with desperation, to join the pair of old witches. Their eyes glittered with madness or terror she could never tell with these two hags.
"Now?"
asked Polly.
"Yes, now."
And Yan Tovis turned round. From her vantage point, she looked upon her cowering followers, her people crowded along the length of beach. Behind them, the forest was a wall of fire, ashes and smoke, a conflagration.
This is what we leave. Remember that."
From where she stood, she could not even see her brother.
"No one need ever ask why we fled this world."
She whirled round, drawing her blessed daggers, and laid open her forearms, the gift of royal blood, to the shore. Pulley and Squish screamed the words of sundering, their twisted hands grasping her wrists, soaking in her blood like leeches.
They should not complain that but two remain. They will learn, I think, to thank my brother when they see what royal blood gives them, when they see.
Darkness yawned, impenetrable, a portal immune to the water that its lower end carved into.
The road home.
Weeping, Yan Tovis, Twilight, Queen of the Sheik, pulled her arms loose from the witch's grip and lunged forward into the cold past, where none could hear her screams of grief. The mob hesitated longer than Yedan expected, hundreds of voices crying out upon witnessing the birth of the portal, those cries turning to need and then anger as the Sheik and the islanders among them plunged into the gate, vanishing, escaping this madness. He stood with his troop, gauging the nearest of the rioters.
Captain Brevity, he called over a shoulder. Watch! Do not tarry here. We will do what needs doing. We got our orders. I said we will hold. Sorry, the woman snapped. We ain't in the mood to watch you go all heroic here. Besides, added Pissy, our lads couldn't live with themselves if they just left you to it.
A half dozen voices loudly objected to her claim, to which both captains laughed. Biting back a smile, Yedan said nothing. The mob was moments from rushing them. They were being pushed from behind. It was always this way, he knew. Someone else's courage, so boisterous in its refuge among walls of flesh, so easy was someone else's life. He could see in heaving eddies the worst of them, and set their details in his mind, to test their courage when at last he came face to face with each one.
"Wake up, soldiers!" he shouted. "Here they come!"
The first task in driving back a charging mob was two quick steps forward, right into the faces of the foremost attackers. Cut them down, pull back a single stride, and hold fast. As the survivors were thrust forward once more, repeat the aggression, messy and brutal, and this time advance into the teeth of the crowd, blades chopping, stabbing, shield rims slamming into bodies, studded heels crunching down on those that fell underfoot. The nearest ranks recoiled from the assault, then retaliated, rising like a wave. Yedan and his troop delivered fierce slaughter, held for 20 frantic heartbeats, and then were driven back one step, and then another. Better armed looters began appearing, thrust to the forefront. The first leathery soldier fell, stabbed through a thigh. Two of Brevity's guards hurried forward and pulled the man from the line, a cutter rushing in to staunch the wound with clumps of spider's web. Pithy shouted from a position directly behind Yedan,
"More than half through, watch!"
The armed foes that fell to his soldiers either reeled back or collapsed at their feet. These latter ones gave up the weapons they held to more of the two captains' guards, who reached through quick as cats to snatch them away before the attackers could recover them. The two women were busy arming others to bolster their rearguard. Yedan could imagine no other reason for the risky and, truth be told, irritating tactic. His soldiers were tiring. It had been some time since they'd last worn full armor. He'd been slack in keeping them fit. Too much riding, not enough marching. When had any of them last drawn blood? The Edor invasion for most of them. They were paying for it now. Ragged gasps, slowing arms, stumbles.
Back one step!
The line edged back.
Now forward, hard!
The mob had seen that retreat as a victory, the beginnings of a rout. The sudden attack into their faces shocked them, their weapons unreadied, their minds on everything but defense. That front line melted, as did the one behind it, and then a third. Yedan and his soldiers, knowing that this was their last push, fought like snarling beasts. And all at once, the hundreds crowding before them suddenly scattered, the rough ranks shattering. Weapons thrown aside, fleeing as fast as legs could carry them, down the strand, out into the shallows. Scores were trampled, driven into mud or stones or water. Fighting broke out in desperate efforts to clear paths through. Yedan withdrew his troop. They staggered back to the waiting rearguard, who looked upon them in silence, perhaps disbelieving.
"Attend to the wounded," barked Yedan,
lifting his cheek grills to cool his throbbing face, snatching in deep breaths.
"We can get moving now,"
Brevity said, tugging at his shield arm.
"We can just walk on through to wherever. You, Watch, you need to be in charge of the Sheik army. Did you know that?"
"The Sheik have no army."
"They better get one, and soon.
Besides, I am an outlaw. I slaughtered..."
"We know what you did. You're an errant damned up-the-wall madman, Yedden Derig. Best kind of commander an army could have."
Pithy said,
"Leave the petitioning to us, sweetie."
And she smiled. He looked round. One wounded, none dead. None dead that counted, anyway. Screams of pain rose from the killing field. He paid that no attention, simply sheathed his sword. When Yedan Derig walked into the fading portalway, the last of them all, he did not look back, not once. There was great joy in discarding useless words. Although one could not help but measure each day by the sun's fiery passage through the empty sky, and each night by the rise and set of a haze-shrouded moon and the jade slashes cutting across the starscape, the essential meaning of time had vanished from Badal's mind. Days and nights were a tumbling cavort. Round and round was no beginning and no end. Jaws to tail. They rolled on and left nothing but a scattering of motionless small figures collapsed onto the plain. Even the ribbers had abandoned them. Here, at the very edge of the glass, there were only the opals, fat carrion beetles migrating in from the blasted, lifeless flanks to either side of the trail. And the diamonds, glittering spiked lizards that sucked blood from the fingertips their jaws clamped tight round every night, diamonds becoming rubies as they grew engorged. And there were the shards, the devouring locusts sweeping down in glittering storms, stripping children almost where they stood, leaving behind snarls of rags, tufts of hair and pink bones. Insects and lizards ruled this scorched realm. Children were interlopers, invaders, food. Rut had tried to lead them round the glass, but there was no way around that vast, blinding desert. A few of them gathered after the second night. They had been walking south, and at this day's end they had found a sinkhole filled with bright green water. It tasted of limestone dust and made many children writhe in pain, clutching their stomachs. It made a few of them die. Rut sat holding Held, and to his left crouched Braderal, the tall, bony girl who reminded Badal of the quitters. She had pushed her way in, and for that Badal did not like her, did not trust her, but Rut turned no one away. Sadik was there as well, a boy who looked upon Badal with abject adoration. It was disgusting, but he listened best to her poems, her sayings, and he could repeat them back to her, word for word. He said he was collecting them all, to one day make a book of this journey. He believed, therefore, that they were going to survive this, and that made him a fool. The four of them had sat, and in the silences that stretched out and round and in and through and sometimes between them all, they pondered what to do next. Words weren't needed for that kind of conversation, and no one had the strength for gestures either. Badal thought that Sadik's book should hold vast numbers of blank pages to mark such silences and all they contained. The truths and the lies, the needs and the wants, the nows and the thens, the theres and the heres. If she saw such pages and could crisp back each one, one after another, she would nod, remembering how it was, how it was. It was Braderal who stained the first blank page.
"We got to go back."
Rut lifted his bloodshot eyes. He drew Held tighter against his chest, adjusted the tattered hood, reached in a lone finger to stroke an unseen cheek. That was his answer, and Badal agreed with him. Yes, she did. Stupid, dangerous Braderal, who scratched a bit at the sores encrusting her nostrils.
"We can't go round it. We can only cross it. But crossing it means we all die, and die bad. I've heard of this glass desert. Never crossed. No one ever crosses it. It goes on forever, straight down the throat of the setting sun.
Oh, Badal liked that one. That was a good scene to keep alive in her head. Down the throat, a diamond throat, a throat of glass, sharp, so very sharp glass. And they were the snake.
"We got thick skin," she said,
since the page was already ruined.
"We go down the throat. We go down it, because that's what snakes do."
"Then we die." They all gave her silence for that. To say such things, to blot the page that way, they gave her silence for that. Rut turned his head. Rut set his eyes upon the glass desert. He stared that way a long, long time, as darkness quenched the glittering flats. And then he finished his looking, and he leaned forward and rocked Held to sleep, rocked and rocked. So it was decided they were going into the glass desert. Braderal took a blank page for herself. She had thousands to choose from. Badal crawled off, trailed by Sadik. And she sat staring into the night. She threw away words. There, here, then, now, when. Everybody had to cut what they carried to cross this desert. Toss away what wasn't needed, even poets.
"You have a poem," Sadik said,
a dark shape beside her.
"I want to hear it. I am throwing away words. You and me is a good place to start. Yesterday I woke up with 5 lizards sucking my fingers, like tiny pigs or rat pups. They drank down you and me. I killed 2 of them and ate what they took, but that wasn't taking back. The words stayed gone. We got to lighten the load, cut down on what we carry. Today I stop carrying you. Tomorrow I stop carrying me."
After a time of no words, Sadik stirred.
"I've got it, Badal. To go with the silent pages." "The what?" "The blank ones. The ones that hold everything that's true. The ones that don't lie about anything. The silent pages, Sadik." "Is that another poem?" "Just don't put it on a blank page." "I won't."
He seemed strangely satisfied, and he curled up tight against her hip, like a ribber when ribbers weren't ribbers but pets, and he went to sleep. She looked down on him and thought about eating his arms.